Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us for the teleclass, Clostridium difficile and environmental cleaning. On behalf of my friend and colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, let me say how pleased we are that you have joined us today. Before I introduce our faculty, let me say that this teleclass is part of the British teleclass series, which is organized by three remarkable ladies. My thanks to Maria Banalek, Lauren Tu, and Vanessa York for doing a tremendous job. Thank you as well to our teleclass sponsor, Johnson Diversey. These guys are great supporters of infection control professionals and infection control education, and I'm honored to have them along as sponsors of this teleclass. Thank you very much to Scott McNeil and to everyone at Johnson Diversey. Our faculty today is Professor Mark Wilcox. Professor Wilcox is a professor of medical microbiology at the University of Leeds, clinical director of microbiology and director of infection control for the Leeds Teaching Hospitals. He was the scientific chairman of the 2002 Hospital Infection Society International Conference and has filled the role of secretary for that organization as well as assistant editor of the Journal of Antimicrobial Chemotherapy. Professor Wilcox is an advisor to the UK National Care Standards Commission, the Department of Health, and the Medicines and Research Products Regulatory Agency for Infection Control Issues. His research projects include several areas of hospital infection, and one of his specialties is Clostridium difficile-associated diarrhea. To give this teleclass, Clostridium difficile and environmental cleaning, I am delighted and honored to present Professor Mark Wilcox.
Hello, and thank you very much for that introduction, and welcome to all of you who are listening to this broadcast. I hope today to be able to shed some light on a difficult area, namely Clostridium difficile infection, but particularly in the context of the environment and what role that has to play. It's difficult because we're still learning. It's difficult because C. diff itself is a difficult organism to culture, to manipulate, and indeed to get answers from. It's a difficult organism to treat and to control. My first slide describes what I'm going to talk about today. Firstly, I'm going to discuss the role of the environment in healthcare-associated infection and in C. difficile infection in general. I'm going to then describe the nosocomial spread, the hospital-acquired nature of Clostridium difficile, and then lastly move into some very applied areas of how hypochlorite-based cleaning may be able to reduce the incidence of C. diff infection. Next slide, please. Most of the recent studies published on the incidence of C. diff diarrhea refer to whole hospital rates, incidence rates. And while this is useful in one context, it hides the true picture, the true incidence of C. diff in those areas of the hospital where it really matters. For example, in one particular study from Sweden, which described the incidence of C. diff diarrhea in 15 different secondary type hospitals and 6 tertiary type hospitals, the whole hospital rate of C. diff diarrhea was 0.2 cases per 100 admissions. But we can see when we look at the equivalent rate in rehabilitation and geriatric units within those hospitals that the rate there is 5 times higher, so 1 per 100 admissions. And that's the rate that really matters, not the whole hospital rate, which is diluted out by pediatric cases and other cases where C. diff infection virtually never occurs. So in many elderly medicine units, C. diff infection is unfortunately endemic, and rates of 2 to 5 cases per 100 admissions are not unusual. And those sorts of rates can be found with some frequency in the literature. Next slide, please. Now, if we step back, first of all, and discuss in general, what is the evidence for the role of environmental contamination in the etiology of hospital-acquired infection? Well, the evidence is not good. And largely, attempts to reduce infection rates by simply enhancing levels of environmental cleaning have proved to be unsuccessful. Next slide. One of the reasons for this is that cleaning has tended in the past to concentrate on cleaning those areas which probably contribute very little, if anything, to nosocomial infection, namely the floors. But in fact, these sets of data which I'll talk through apply to potentially any horizontal surface. And the message here is that if a horizontal surface, in this case the floor, is cleaned, then within a very short space of time, and here we can see in the context of a general surgical ward, that may mean only within 2 or 3 hours, that contamination rates have returned to those which existed before the floor was cleaned. It takes a bit longer for that situation to occur in an operating theatre where there's a lower bioburden in the air, but still, within 4 to 5 hours, contamination levels on the floor of an operating theatre are back to those levels where they were prior to cleaning. And so, it's not surprising that for horizontal surfaces, unless one was intending to clean them every 2, 3, or 4 hours, then bioburdens are going to persistently return to those levels which exist before cleaning. And clearly that's not practicable in a healthcare situation to clean to that extent. Next slide, please. Now, having said that simply concentrate on cleaning horizontal surfaces is unlikely to yield success in the context of controlling hospital infection. Against that, we need to consider that there is good evidence that C. diff spores can and indeed do survive and persist for days, weeks, months, and indeed there are reports of spores surviving for over a year in the environment. Also, C. diff, as we've already said, is endemic in many units, and I'll talk about this in more detail to come, there is evidence of enhanced virulence of particular C. diff strains. I'll also talk about the data later on to back up the last point on this slide, and that is that if we use the wrong cleaning agent, we may potentially make the persistence of spores in the environment worse. So C. diff is unfortunately one of the best examples of an organism that can survive in the environment for all of these reasons. Next slide, please. Now, what's the evidence base for C. diff spores surviving in the environment? Well, if you put those words, those four words, into a PubMed Medline search, a grand total of 9 hits occurs. So the evidence base is not great. We all need to be aware of that. Next slide, please. So before we talk about how to potentially solve the problem, what about the environmental epidemiology in some detail of C. diff? Well, it's been known for a long time, and the data on this slide really pertain from the early 1980s. And remember that C. diff diarrhea associated with initially lincomycin and clindamycin was only described in 1978-79, within a very short space of time. We knew that C. diff contaminates the ward environment, the hospital environment, and in particular, it contaminates the environment where patients have diarrhea. So, where there are carriers with diarrhea, then contamination rates, at least in the early 80s, of about 9-10% were being reported, as opposed to much lower contamination rates, about a quarter as high, in sites that were housing non-C. diff carriers. And that's clearly a significant difference. We've known for some time that C. diff can be isolated not only from the environment but also from the hands and in some cases from the stools of asymptomatic hospital personnel. C. diff is widely distributed in the environment. I'll show you some data about this to come, and so we can find it wherever we find evidence of contaminated water, soil contaminated or fecally contaminated water, and indeed wherever we find soil. We can also find evidence of C. diff in the home situation, but more of that in a short while. As we've already said, we've known for some time that C. diff can persist, and again, from the early 1980s, we knew that C. diff inoculated onto a floor persisted there for 5 months at least. Next slide. These data were all obtained from an extensive amount of environmental sampling that took place from various sites in hospitals and the environment of South Wales in the UK. You can see here that whether we look at water, and whether that's river, lake, seawater, then very high rates of C. diff contamination. Not that surprising. Swimming pool water is also frequently contaminated, and remember that's despite chlorination levels, significantly higher chlorination levels. And even one of 18 mains tap water samples were found to have C. diff in them in this particular survey. Probably relates to biofilm contamination of old pipework supplying the taps that were sampled. I'm not suggesting here that C. diff is found with any degree of frequency in normal chlorinated tap water supplies. As I've already said, C. diff is, like other Clostridia, is a soil-borne organism. Not surprisingly, it's found sometimes on raw vegetables. Probably should be higher than that figure, but they've probably been washed in this particular sample. If you look for C. diff in the feces of dogs and cats, we can find evidence of the organism in a minority of cases, but by and large, the strains that we find from those settings differ from the strains that affect humans. So there's no good evidence that C. diff is a zoonosis. Now, if we contrast those prevalences with the prevalence in this study, an average prevalence of 20% for C. diff in the hospital environment from four different units that were sampled. Next slide, please. Now, those figures that I've just reported need to be taken with some caution. And in reality, the real figures are probably higher still. And they're higher still because it's important that we use optimal isolation procedures to recover C. diff, not only from the environment, but indeed from any specimen. And that's been known for some time. Remember we said at the start, C. diff is a difficult organism to recover, to culture. These data essentially show that if we use a variety of different approaches, in this case four different approaches, to culturing C. diff, we can get different answers. And CCEY is a commercially available solid agar for recovering C. diff. It stands for cofoxitin, cycloserin, egg yolk agar. And it's an alternative to CCFA, which is available in some other parts of the world. And it's a recognized gold standard for culturing C. diff. But you'll see here that we can more than double the recovery rates for C. diff from the environment by incorporating lysozyme into CCEY. Why lysozyme? Well, lysozyme, a naturally produced enzyme, probably in this case, is able to break open the spore coat surrounding these dormant spores that are in the environment. And so we significantly enhance the recovery, probably from waking up super dormant spores that exist in the environment. Using an enrichment approach with alkaline thioglycolate is an alternative to incorporating lysozyme, but it's a much more fussy procedure. The only other thing to say about this is that this is looking at the different results when culturing C. diff on a solid agar. One should always enrich samples recovered from the environment in addition to culturing on agar, because recovery rates increase yet further if we enrich the sample as well. Next slide, please. Now, before I proceed to talk in more detail about C. diff and environmental cleaning, we mustn't lose sight of the fact that C. diff is an antibiotic-driven organism. And so C. diff diarrhea is clearly related to antibiotic exposure. The prime way of controlling C. diff infection is by controlling antibiotic prescribing. One example of that at level of control is from this study which we carried out in Leeds in the UK in the mid-1990s. Here we used in one group of patients on one ward cefotaxime as the prime antibiotic for treating empirical infected patients. On the other ward, we used a different broad-spectrum antibiotic called piperacillin tazobactam, PT, on this slide. We can see here that there was a highly significant difference in terms of the incidence of C. diff colonization and, more importantly, of C. diff diarrhea in patients who received cefotaxime as opposed to piperacillin tazobactam. The significant difference amounted to a more than sevenfold increased risk of C. diff diarrhea associated with cefotaxime use. And this sort of finding has been shown in many other settings, that certain antibiotics, in this case broad-spectrum cephalosporins, drive C. diff diarrhea. Next slide, please. Now, the other reason for mentioning the important role of antibiotics here is that the particular study I've just referred to yielded some important information about C. diff environmental contamination. Here's one of the data for one of the two wards in this crossover study. This is an elderly medicine setting, and initially it was the winter period when we started using cefotaxime on ward A. During that period, before switching over to piperacillin tazobactam, we saw an increased number of C. diff cases and an increase in environmental C. diff contamination. Remember the association we talked about earlier? Patients with diarrhea equals C. diff increasing in the environment. In the summer period, when this particular ward switched from cefotaxime to piperacillin tazobactam prescribing, we saw a significant decrease in environmental C. diff contamination levels. On the other ward, Ward B, started off in the winter period when we would expect to see potentially an increase in C. diff rates anyway because of an increase in diarrhea during the winter on normal hospital wards. But the small increase that was seen during this period associated with piperacillin tazobactam use was not significant. When that ward switched, now summer, to cefotaxime prescribing, we'd expect a partly protective effect of summer on diarrhea and therefore environmental contamination rates. And cefotaxime in this case didn't increase environmental contamination. Next slide, please. While we strive to have healthcare settings as clean and hygienic as possible, unfortunately that's not always the case. Next slide, please. This is a scanning electron micrograph of the edge of a colony of C. diff growing on an agar plate. And we can see straight away that this population of bacteria, like a series of small sticks lying end to end, is not uniform. The arrowed structures show the bulbous terminal ends of spores of C. diff, which are in the minority in this picture, the majority of the cells being the vegetative form, which are highly susceptible to oxygen. Next slide, please. This is an acridine orange stained slide of cells from the same colony referred to in the previous micrograph. Acridine orange is a vital dye, which means that it stains RNA, living material. The reason I show this slide is to emphasize that anything that lights up in this stain, whether it's orange or yellow, means that it contains RNA and is alive. We can clearly see here that the spores, the rounded, non-stick-like objects, the spores light up. They have RNA in them. They are alive. So while they're asleep, they're still alive, waiting for the right conditions to germinate and then start multiplying. Next slide, please. These data I'm going to show you refer to what happened in an elderly medicine ward in a hospital in Leeds, UK. And this was a new ward, which up until the 6th of October in this particular year had been a non-clinical area. We sampled it the day before patients moved in on the 7th of October. We found no evidence of C. diff. Next slide. We can see that subsequently, within 1 week, by the 13th of October, and then on, by the 27th of October, and so on, more and more sites became contaminated with C. diff. When we see one plus on this slide, that means that at least one swab, but usually multiple swabs from that particular site, was C. diff positive. And we can see that in between the 31st of January, in the year following the ward's opening, and the 9th of April, there was a decrease in the number of sites and the intensity of C. diff contamination. What happened in between these two times? Well, there was an outbreak of viral gastroenteritis on this particular ward, and the ward was so-called deep cleaned. What does deep clean meaning? Well, unfortunately in this case, it probably just means cleaning better than the cleaning that's going on normally from day to day and week to week. And the simple message here is that, unfortunately, it's no more scientific than the case that the better you clean, then the more C. diff will be removed from the environment. There is an influence by the agent you use, and we'll come on to that shortly, but it still is heavily reliant on the way and the manner in which the environment is cleaned. The last set of data I refer to on this slide in blue show that on the 9th of April 1996, 6 months after opening this particular ward, almost 70% of high dust sites were C. diff positive. That's within 6 months of opening, again emphasizing the potential for buildup of C. diff in the environment in a C. diff endemic setting. Next slide, please. I'm not going to talk through these data, but they show the same pattern, virtually identical buildup of C. diff in the environment occurring with time of a new hospital ward, different hospital ward from the previous data. Next slide, please. So why does it matter what's in the environment? Is the environment simply reflecting what's in patients? Well, to some extent it probably is reflecting what's in patients, but the reason it matters is that quite simply, the more prevalent C. diff is in the environment, the more contaminated the environment is, then the greater the incidence of contamination of hands of healthcare workers working in that environment. And so we can see that in this slide here, that as the environment becomes more contaminated, from zero sites being contaminated to greater than 50% of sites being contaminated, so the proportion of healthcare workers' hands that are C. diff contaminated increases. And that's a highly significant correlation. Next slide, please. These are data from one healthcare elderly ward, and they show the association between the incidence of C. diff diarrhea, and that's shown in yellow, and the prevalence of C. diff in the environment, which is shown in blue. And you can see here that there is a significant correlation between those two parameters. However, before we think that the association is as fixed as that, from a similar ward in the same block of the hospital with the same type of patients, we see the data in the next slide for Ward B. And here, clearly, there is no correlation between the incidence of C. diff diarrhea and the prevalence of C. diff in the environment. And two important messages come from these sets of data. Firstly, that there may, in some settings, be a significant correlation between these two parameters, but we cannot assume that that always exists. And that's an important lesson from experimental data in general, that we cannot extrapolate from one series of data and assume that that applies in all other settings. Now, we've repeated these observations on pairs of wards when they've moved from one building to another, and we cannot explain why the difference exists. Antibiotic usage is not dissimilar in these two wards, and infection control practices are not dissimilar. So to this day, we cannot explain this difference. Next slide, please. So which areas of the ward setting, the hospital setting, are most likely to become C. diff positive? Well, these data don't hold any great surprises in that those areas that are more likely to become fecally contaminated are those areas that are more likely to be C. diff positive. But, and I stress but, remember that all these sites, the data that we obtain from these sites, are sites that are meant to be being cleaned on a regular basis. And yet we still see some extremely high prevalences of C. diff contamination. Next slide, please. If we consider the evidence for contamination in the environment by C. diff in isolation rooms, rooms used to house C. diff infected patients, we can see that as we followed these 33 different side rooms over the ensuing weeks, after 4 weeks, more than a quarter of the sites were still C. diff positive. And these side rooms were meant to be being cleaned not once, but twice daily. So we're putting patients into isolation to protect other patients from acquiring C. diff. But it would appear that we're not protecting the patient, him or herself, from environmental re-exposure to C. diff. And this might give us some clues as to why relapse, recurrence rates in the elderly in particular of C. diff diarrhea are so high. Patients are not being protected from re-exposure to C. diff, and their inherent capacity to be infected by C. diff is presumably being met by re-challenge from the organism in the environment. Next slide. From the side room study that I just showed you, these were the sites that were most frequently C. diff contaminated. Again, these are no great surprise. Horizontal surfaces are most likely to become fecally contaminated. Next slide, please. If we DNA fingerprint, and it doesn't matter which method has been used, but use some discriminatory method for being able to decide which strains are the same and which are different, of isolates collected from patients who are infected with C. diff, then in our hospital setting, we see this sort of picture. The trace in the middle are molecular weight markers, but all the other traces are essentially indistinguishable, showing that we have a common endemic and indeed epidemic C. diff strain. The next slide shows the DNA fingerprints of strains recovered from the environment, which, although some of them are similar, tend to be more heterogeneous. Now, this slide shown previously, showing the endemic strain, highlights that one particular strain in our hospital is responsible for about 90% of all the C. diff diarrhea cases we see in elderly patients. That particular strain is known as PCR ribotype 1, as designated by the anaerobe reference unit in the UK. And that strain is responsible for about 60% of all isolates causing C. diff diarrhea in the UK. The strain has spread beyond the UK, and there are reports from Canada, Europe, and the US of that particular epidemic strain. So there's clearly something special about this strain which makes it so successful. Next slide, please. These data, it's quite a complicated slide, but they show the distribution of a different ribotype to the strain I've just referred to. So these are data about, not about the UK epidemic strain, but a ribotype 3 on one particular ward. What the data show is that we see a complex pattern of just one particular ribotype being recoverable from multiple different environmental sites, but also from a member of staff, patient hands, but also from patients themselves. And we see a complicated picture of environmental contamination, patient carriage, and indeed in some cases, staff hand carriage. Next slide, please. I already referred to these data near the start of the talk, and these are generated by in vitro experiments. But here we were trying to see what the effect of exposure of different C. diff strains is to different sorts of detergent or disinfectant that are used in the hospital setting. Three strains were used, P24, B31 and E4. P24 happens to be the UK epidemic strain, which I've already referred to, ribotype 1. And that's the strain I'd like to concentrate on in this slide, so the blue bars. We can see that if we look at the control data on the left-hand side, that when we do nothing to this strain or to its comparators, we see that it successfully sporulates more than do comparator strains. So this is one explanation why this particular strain is so successful, why it's epidemic. But if we then expose the strains to Hospec, D2 or D4, which are all different forms of detergent as opposed to disinfectant, they're all in use in the hospital setting, then we see that the UK epidemic strain, P24, sporulates more effectively. So by exposing the UK epidemic strain to levels of detergent which aren't sufficient to kill it, we can actually make matters potentially worse in terms of making more of the organism sporulate. So if the environment becomes contaminated by C. diff-containing feces, if detergent comes into contact with that feces, and insufficient concentrations to kill the organisms, it may force them into spore forms, which, as we already know, are highly resistant. However, if we, in the same experimental setting, use DivaCare or Saniclaw, which are simply bleach-like products, hypochlorite-containing products, then the increase in sporulation that we saw with detergents is not seen. So the slightly higher bar that's seen, blue bar that's seen following exposure to DivaCare, is not significantly greater in terms of the sporulation amount than seen with the control strain. So, overall message, that by using hypochlorite-containing products, we may prevent sporulation increasing more effectively in the environment, which, of course, can only be a good thing. Next slide, please. So, briefly, what are the data and the evidence so far to support use of hypochlorite in controlling C. diff infection? In the 1980s, Katz and colleagues reported an outbreak of C. diff infection, which was terminated once they started to disinfect the environment with hyperchlorite, and initially they used unbuffered hyperchlorite at a concentration of 500 parts per million available chlorine. They noted that surface contamination levels by C. diff decreased to about a fifth of initial levels. Phosphate buffered hyperchlorite, when they investigated this at 1600 parts per million, and it was buffered at a pH of 7.6, was found to be even more effective at reducing environmental contamination levels. And indeed, almost 100%, 98% reduction in surface contamination was achieved. Next slide, please. In another clinical setting, Mayfield and colleagues found that the incidence of C. diff infection on a bone marrow transplant unit decreased significantly when hyperchlorite was used for environmental disinfection, as opposed to a quaternary ammonium compound. When they then reintroduced quaternary ammonium-based cleaning, the C. diff infection rates increased back almost to baseline levels. Unfortunately, in this study, environmental C. diff prevalence was not measured, and, perhaps crucially, antibiotic use altered during the study period. We've already talked about the importance, prime importance of antibiotic use driving C. diff infection rates. Furthermore, the results that on face value looked impressive in the bone marrow transplant unit were not reproducible for patients on other units. Next slide, please. These data are from our own crossover study, where our hypothesis was that simply by altering from a detergent-based cleaning regimen to a hyperchlorite-based cleaning regimen for the environment, that we could reduce C. diff infection rates. We did not seek to alter antibiotic prescribing rates at all. These data show, and I'd like to concentrate on the upper two pair of graphs, that when we looked at the instance of C. diff infection, that decreased, that's the red bars, that significantly decreased when we moved from detergent-based cleaning to hyperchlorite-based cleaning. The data are summarized better on the next slide. For Ward X, which is one of the two wards that we studied, we can see that in the period in the quarters 5 and 6, which are reflected by the purple box, the incidence of C. diff toxin positive patients, of diarrheal patients, decreased significantly. And those two quarters, quarters 5 and 6, were the last two quarters of a 12-month period where we were carrying out hyperchlorite-based cleaning on that ward. Beforehand, so in quarters 1 and 2, we'd been using detergent to clean the environment. And after quarter 6, so for quarters 7 and 8, we returned back to detergent-based cleaning. So, for this particular ward, hyperchlorite-based cleaning was associated with a significant reduction in the instance of C. diff diarrhea. However, rather similar to the other pairs of ward data that I showed you earlier, we were unable to show this effect on the other ward, which we studied. And indeed, on that ward, the C. diff diarrhea rates remained unchanged when we switched from detergent to hyperchlorite. Nevertheless, at least in some ward settings, the data appear to be consistent that hyperchlorite-based cleaning can reduce the instance of C. diff diarrhea. I must stress, though, it's difficult to carry out these sorts of studies and ensure that other confounding factors, in particular antibiotic use and other infection control approaches, are kept consistent. Next slide, please. Now, while we've talked about the potential advantages of using hyperchlorite, we need to stress some of the downsides. There are significant health and safety issues of using hyperchlorite-based cleaning. These are toxic agents which have questionable practicability over long-term use and then in terms of their damage to surfaces. There's an environmental cost in terms of disposal of hyperchlorite. And of course, there is a questionable efficacy in the presence of organic matter. In other words, dirty surfaces may not be effectively cleaned by hyperchlorite alone. However, there are now a series of combination products available which combine a detergent and hyperchlorite within the same product to allow once-only cleaning. Alternatively, if these combination products are not used, then visibly dirty surfaces will have to be first cleaned with detergent and then cleaned with hyperchlorite. Next slide, please. To summarize, there are a whole series of risks that contribute to the development of C. diff infection. C. diff infection, as we've already discussed, is most prevalent in the elderly patient. Next slide, please. If, in addition to being the wrong side of 65 years, the patient is exposed to the wrong sort of antibiotic, that is an antibiotic that can significantly inhibit the anaerobic component of their gut flora. If the patient is also exposed to C. diff or perhaps is already colonized by C. diff, if that C. diff strain is resistant to the antibiotic to which they have been exposed and so is allowed a selective advantage to grow and multiply in the gut, and if the C. diff strain is particularly virulent, and we've talked about one example of such a virulent strain today, then if we combine these factors with as yet a poorly understood but almost certainly important issue about the patient who has a poor host response, and we know, for example, that some patients are less able to produce an antibody response to the toxin or toxins that C. diff produces. These are the sort of situation where a patient is obviously going to be extremely high risk of developing C. diff infection. Next slide, please. But from these risks, there is hope in terms of risk factors that we can remove or ameliorate. We can influence which antibiotics the patient are exposed to, and so influence whether their gut flora is inhibited to a greater or lesser extent. We can, of course, control their exposure to C. diff, and that's what we've been talking about today, by reducing the opportunity that the patient comes into contact and then ingests C. diff. And then lastly, and I think we'll hear more about this in the future, we will increasingly be able to control the host response to C. diff and perhaps replace deficient host response in at-risk patients. I'd like to thank you for listening, and if there are questions, I'll do my best to answer them. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Professor Wilcox, for an excellent lecture. Your point that non-chlorine detergents and disinfectants can actually encourage the growth of Clostridium difficile is really fascinating. I've not heard that before. Do we know yet why that is?
No, well, we don't for definite, but it's probably something to do with the interaction of detergents with the spore itself and with C. diff itself. As I showed you from the slide of the acridine orange stained spores, C. diff spores are alive. Although they're sleepy, they are active to a certain extent. And if we expose strains which haven't yet turned into a full spore form, so we expose these cells which are on the verge of turning into spores, to certain agents, it's clear that we can influence how many of them then continue successfully to go on to the spore form stage, that they undergo all the metabolic changes successfully to shut down their operation, build up this special coat and go to sleep. And it would appear, without understanding the biochemical reasons, that detergent exposure can do that more successfully than simply exposing a strain to a hypochlorite-based disinfectant.
When thinking of the residues that are left behind on a surface after they've been disinfected with a quaternary ammonium or phenolic disinfectant, those would be sublethal residues. Would they likely have the same effect?
Well, it's certainly plausible that they could have the same effect, and that there are several reports in the literature of outbreaks of infection that are have been associated with, for example, quaternary ammonium compound-based cleaning. We haven't studied those agents in particular, but they are widely available in cleaning products, and they have the potential to do this, but I haven't shown that, and I couldn't give you a definite answer there.
Well, one last question then. With regard to the chlorine-based disinfectants, can we speculate that it's because they are oxidizing agents that they have this effect?
Well, that's possible, yes. I mean, they're likely to be to have a higher lethality anyway than the non-chlorine-based agents. And it's probably the crucial issue is not so much the activity against the spore itself. It's against those strains, that are, those vegetative forms that are just turning from being vegetative into the spore form. And I expect that hypochlorites-based disinfectants are significantly more able to kill those strains than are quaternary ammonium compounds. So it's a combination of, can you kill the strains more effectively versus, is this detergent going to stimulate sporulation? Because remember, a strain probably doesn't actually want to go to sleep. It doesn't want to go into a spore form. It wants to stay in metabolically active form. And it really will only do that as a last resort because there may be no way back from that. So having said that, it's not advantageous for us, for obvious reasons, that strains are encouraged to sporulate because of their very long persistence.
Wow, that's fascinating. I gather we'll see much more research on this in the years to come. Thanks again to Maria and Lauren and Vanessa for their commitment to the British Teleclass series, and a special thanks as well to Johnson Diversey for their sponsorship of this teleclass. Professor Wilcox, thank you again for presenting this useful teleclass. And folk, until we meet again, goodbye.